Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the American Expression teaching series, Words and Their Stories, with Anna Mateo. Later, we bring you the American History series, Making of a Nation. But first, this report.
Social organizations have long been a part of the student experience at colleges and universities in the United States. Fraternities and sororities have been a major part of the experience for so long, it is almost hard to imagine U.S. higher education without them. Many Americans use the term Greek life for fraternities and sororities because their names come from letters in the Greek language. Taking part in such groups does cost money, but there are many reasons students join them. At many U.S. colleges and universities, fraternities and sororities provide housing for students. They also help students make new friends and personal connections, both in and out of school. Some of these organizations were set up mainly for a given field of study, religion, or other activity, such as musical performance. Most Greek life groups expect members to get involved with their community through service. But there is also a culture of partying, drinking alcohol, and even bad behavior among some of the groups. One way Greek organizations try to demonstrate their value to students is by suggesting that joining improves members' academic performance and earnings after college. So a team of U.S. researchers decided to look at how Greek life affected students in those areas.
The researchers are with Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. They looked at the academic performance of over 34,100 students at a large, unnamed public university over a 10-year period. They also looked at how much money the former students of that school earned. The researchers released their findings through the publishing service SSRN last October. Almost every college and university with fraternities and sororities sets academic requirements for their members. To take part in Greek life, students must keep their grade point average, or GPA, at or above a given level. At the university in the study, the lowest level of GPA a Greek life member can have is 2.5 out of a possible 4.0. The school in the study does not let its students join fraternities and sororities until the second half of their first year. So the researchers were able to compare the students' GPAs before and after they joined Greek life. They found that on average, the GPAs of Greek life members fell by about 0.25 points after they joined. Academic performance was a problem, especially during a period known as rush, the researchers noted. Before letting a student become a member, he or she is required to complete difficult tasks during rush, often involving alcohol. The researchers found that this was a period when students dropped out of classes or more often chose to take easier ones. William Evan is a professor of economics at Miami University and the lead researcher in the study. He says the decrease in academic performance among Greek Life members was greater than among students who started college at the same time but chose not to join.
Bottom line, our study shows that the simple statistics on GPA paint a false picture of how joining a fraternity or sorority affects grades, Evan wrote in a message to VOA. Closer inspection reveals negative effects. Evan said the study found no evidence that being a member of one of these groups improves a student's earnings after college, as some Greek organizations claim. The North American Interfraternity Conference and the National Panhellenic Conference are the two biggest supporters of Greek Life in the country. Leaders from the two groups released a joint statement through the Chronicle of Higher Education after the findings were released. The leaders stated that they were pleased the researchers looked at the issues of academic performance among Greek Life members. But they also noted the researchers looked only at one school. A host of studies show membership contributes to a student's sense of community and belonging on campus, which provides a greater sense of attachment to a university, they wrote. The Greek organization's leaders pointed to two other studies. One study was done by the Association of Fraternity Advisors in 2006. It found that fraternity members are 20% more likely to successfully complete their studies than non-members. The other study, from 2014, looked at sorority members. It found that they are 11% more likely to stay with their study programs between the first and second years in college, a point when many students leave.
In addition, there are things that being part of Greek Life teaches students that they do not necessarily get in the classroom, says Roberto Angulo. He helped create After College, an internet-based service that helps students find the best possible jobs for their skill sets after they complete their college studies. He was also a member of the Kappa Alpha fraternity while attending Stanford University in the mid-1990s. Angulo notes that many companies do want workers who are highly knowledgeable of the areas in which they work. But he argues they also want job candidates with more general skills, like leadership and the ability to work well with others. Membership in Greek organizations demonstrates these qualities through the many community service projects in which they are involved. Employers who were once members of a Greek group themselves are more likely to employ fellow members, Angulo says. And the social skills one gains from involvement are also helpful in fields like business and sales, he adds. Also, they can be very useful when an individual wants to progress in his or her career path. If you want to get a raise, it's not so much based on your GPA, said Angulo. It's how willing you are to ask for that extra package when you start, or how actively you negotiate your offers. Still, fraternities and sororities have other issues affecting the way the public looks at them. These issues include reports of alcohol abuse, physical and verbal abuse of membership candidates, and sexual violence. Some groups have been named in police investigations and even court cases. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Each week, we teach expressions often used in American English. We explain how to use them and sometimes where they come from. But do not take my word for it. Go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. You will soon see for yourself that our teaching methods work. Or, as we like to say, the proof is in the pudding. This expression means that the best way to find out if something is good or successful is to test it yourself. The Oxford Dictionary of Quotations claims this expression was first used in the early 14th century. As with many expressions, this one has changed over the years. People back then said it this way: "The proof of the pudding is in the eating." Knowing the full original version is important when explaining this expression. Also important is understanding the two main words in the sentence, pudding and proof. First, pudding. You may ask, what is that? Well, the answer depends on whether you are using American English or British English. In the United States, Canada, and many countries in South America, pudding is a treat made with milk, eggs, sugar, and flavoring, like vanilla or chocolate. However, if you order pudding at a restaurant in London and expect a soft, sweet dessert, you could be in for a big surprise. In Britain, pudding is a savory meat dish. In fact, the British would call our sweet dessert pudding a custard. Now, the British do have sweet puddings, such as their sticky toffee pudding and Christmas pudding. But they are solid puddings made with a lot of dried fruits. Again, nothing like an American milk-based pudding. And their savory puddings are even more different. Centuries ago in Britain, people combined different meats, placed them into an animal membrane or tissue, and then made a kind of sausage. They covered the meat filling with a soft shell made from flour and meat fat. Then they would cook the pudding by boiling or steaming it. Like I said, the two puddings are very different. But it is this traditional English pudding that gives us the expression, "the proof is in the pudding." And that brings us to the second word, proof. Today, proof means something that shows that something else is true. A similar word is evidence. But centuries ago, proof meant to test something. So we could say the expression this way: the test of the pudding is in the eating. And now another question. Why is testing the pudding important? Well, to answer this, we need to go back to the main ingredient in the British pudding, sausage. Centuries ago, there was no refrigeration to keep food cool and fresh. So meat would often go bad. If you weren't careful, you could get botulism, a foodborne sickness. And the root word of botulism, botulus, is the Latin word for, you guessed it, sausage. So testing the pudding was the only way to really know if the meat was still good to eat. So that is the story of this expression. Now let's talk about when and how to use it. The proof is in the pudding is very common. I would feel at home using it with an office supervisor, strangers, or people much older than me. Other ways to say this expression are, I'll believe that when I see it, and I'll be the judge of that. These are both a little more casual. To best explain how to use it, I'll give you a few examples. In this first one, a woman's car won't start, so her friend is helping to fix it. Or is he?
And then after I connect this wire here, your car will be fixed.
Are you sure? That doesn't look right.
Yes, I'm sure.
Well, the proof is in the pudding. Let's start it up. Yeah, I didn't think that was right. Here, give me the tools. In this next example, a team leader is talking to a group of computer programmers. They have been working hard on a new product and are preparing to test it.
All right, team, this is it. We have written the program and designed the website. Tomorrow, we run our first live test.
We have worked so hard. I'm sure it'll work.
I know you've all worked really hard, but the proof is in the pudding. If it doesn't work, be prepared to work over the weekend to fix it.
And that is all the time we have for Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the early weeks of 1863, the American Civil War took a new political direction. President Abraham Lincoln had announced the Emancipation Proclamation. That measure freed the slaves in the rebel states of the South, though Lincoln's words fell on deaf ears. Yet no longer was the Civil War a struggle just to save the Union. It had become a struggle for human freedom. There was a change on the military side of the war, too. President Lincoln named a new commander for the Union's Army of the Potomac. This was the force that would try again to capture the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant describe events during the spring of 1863.
General Joe Hooker was the new commander of the Army of the Potomac. He replaced General Ambrose Burnside when Burnside suffered a terrible defeat at Fredericksburg, Virginia, at the end of 1862. Burnside had replaced General George McClellan when McClellan kept refusing to obey President Lincoln's orders. Hooker had 130,000 men. They were well trained and well supplied. The Confederate force opposing Hooker's was under the command of General Robert E. Lee. Lee had only about 60,000 men. They did not have good equipment, and their supplies were low. But their fighting spirit was high. They had defeated the Union Army before. They were sure they could do it again.
Lee's army still held strong defensive positions along high ground south of Fredericksburg. This was almost halfway between the capitals of the opposing sides, Washington and Richmond. General Hooker did not plan to make the same mistake which General Burnside made at Fredericksburg. Burnside had thrown his army against Lee's defensive positions 6 times. Each time, the Confederates pushed them back easily. In one day of fighting, more than 12,000 Union soldiers were killed or wounded. General Hooker had rebuilt the Army of the Potomac. Now he was ready to carry out his plan against General Lee. Hooker left half his men at Fredericksburg in front of Lee's army. He would move the other half into position behind Lee's army. If Lee turned to meet him, the troops at Fredericksburg would attack. The Confederate army would be caught between two powerful forces. Lee would have to withdraw or lose his army.
Hooker moved around past the end of Lee's line. Then he turned and started marching back behind it. It was a hard march through thick woods and across rough hills and valleys. The country was so wild that it was called the Wilderness. On the last day of April, 1863, the Union force reached Chancellorsville. Chancellorsville was a crossroads near the edge of the Wilderness. The next day, the soldiers would be in open country. There, General Hooker could make the best use of his men. Hooker was extremely pleased. Everything was going as he had planned. He told his officers, "I have Lee in one hand and Richmond in the other." The next day, Union soldiers began moving out of Chancellorsville and the Wilderness. They did not get far. They ran into several thousand Confederate soldiers. Lee had sent them to slow the Union force.
The Confederate force was weak. General Hooker's officers believed they could smash through it without difficulty. They did not get a chance to try. Hooker sent new orders: break off the fight, return to Chancellorsville, put up defensive positions. Hooker's officers were shocked. They protested. Hooker stood firm. He said, "Lee must fight me on my own ground." Robert E. Lee could not understand why the Union force had returned to Chancellorsville, but he was happy it did. Now he had time to prepare his men for battle.
Lee met that night with his top general, Stonewall Jackson. They discussed the best way to attack the Union force. The center of the Union line was strong. The right side was not. Jackson was sure he could get around behind it. Lee asked Jackson how many men he would take. "All of them," Jackson answered, 28,000. This meant Lee would have only 14,000 men to face General Hooker. If the Union force attacked before Stonewall Jackson got into position, Lee could not possibly hold it back. Lee was taking a huge chance. He thought about it for a moment. Then he told Jackson to get started.
Jackson's men began to leave the next morning. Union soldiers watched as they marched away. General Hooker thought Lee was withdrawing. It took Jackson only half a day to get behind the Union force. He spent a few more hours putting his troops into position. Then he attacked. It was 6 o'clock in the evening. The right end of the Union force was not prepared for an attack. The soldiers could not believe their eyes when they saw Confederate troops running out of the woods behind them. Many Union soldiers were killed or wounded. Thousands fled. The sun went down. The fighting continued under a bright moon. the Confederate troops kept moving forward. The Union troops kept falling back. One Northern soldier wrote later, "Darkness was upon us. Jackson was upon us, and fear was upon us."
Jackson seemed to be everywhere. He rode his horse among his men, urging them forward. He would not let the Union force escape. As Jackson and some of his officers rode into a cleared area of the woods, shots rang out. The bullets came from Confederate guns. The Confederate soldiers thought they were firing on Union officers. Jackson fell from his horse. Two bullets had smashed his left arm. Another bullet had hit his right hand. He was hurried to the back of the line. A doctor quickly cut off his left arm and stopped the heavy bleeding. Jackson seemed to get better. Then he developed pneumonia. He was unconscious most of the time. He seemed to dream of battle and shouted commands to his officers. Then he grew quiet. He opened his eyes and said, "Let us pass over the river and rest in the shade of the trees." The great Confederate general Stonewall Jackson was dead.
While Jackson lay dying, the Battle of Chancellorsville continued. Robert E. Lee's Confederate army was much smaller than Joe Hooker's Union army. But for 5 days, Lee kept part of his army moving between Chancellorsville and Fredericksburg. Wherever the Union army attacked, Lee quickly added more men to his lines. The Union army could not break through. The fighting was taking place on the south side of the Rappahannock River. The Union army's supply lines were on the north side. Spring rains were beginning to make the Rappahannock rise. General Hooker did not want to get trapped without food and ammunition, so he ordered his men back across the river.
The South had won the Battle of Chancellorsville. Robert E. Lee was sure of that. Once again, he had forced back the Army of the Potomac. But the Union Army was not hurt seriously. New soldiers would soon take the place of those lost in battle. Lee, however, would find it more difficult to replace his soldiers. The South was running out of manpower. Every Confederate army needed men, more and more men. Yet fewer and fewer Southern boys were willing to become soldiers. Anti-war movements were, in fact, active in both the North and South. There were a number of protests against the military draft. Some turned violent. In the North, a political party was created to oppose the Civil War. Leaders of this peace party were called Copperheads. They got the name because they wore a copper penny showing the head of an Indian. That will be our story in our next program on the Civil War.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.